Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sometimes it feels like no matter what we do, the economy is just against us, you know? Case in point, the jobs report this morning, one step forward, about a step and a half or so back. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 7th of February, and we are going to get a little Dickensian to start things off today. If you might call the January unemployment report that was released this morning a tale of two surveys. First, what's called the establishment survey, where businesses are asked how many jobs they created. Just 113,000 of them last month. Not so good, in point of fact. And then there's the household survey, which, yes, surveys households and asks them how many people found jobs. That one showed more than 600,000 people did last month and helped kick the unemployment rate down to 6.6%. That's down a tenth percent. So which of those two surveys do we believe? Help me out here. Kate Davidson gets us going.
If conflicting employment reports stress you out, close your eyes and imagine the beach. Doug Handler is chief U.S. economist for IHS Global Insight. He says the survey where tens of thousands of households reported that nice bump in employment, it's less precise than the payroll data.
It's like trying to predict the amount of water in the ocean by looking at the waves here. You can broadly get a number, but from minute to minute or from month to month, it's tough to predict.
Plus, the household survey and the payroll tabulation measure slightly different things. Harry Holzer is a professor at Georgetown University.
The self-employed in the household survey will say that they are employed, and there's no such category in the payroll numbers because it's only for employees.
While many economists prefer the payroll survey, they say there's something to the optimism in the household survey, that it should temper the gloom of the last two payroll reports. Mark Vittner is senior economist at Wells Fargo. He knows folks were disappointed with today's numbers.
They said, well, the unemployment rate's been declining, but it's been declining, and it's all because of a drop in the labor force. Well, labor force didn't decline, it actually increased.
He says low job gains in December and January may have been caused by weather. And he says those disappointing payroll numbers may not look all that disappointing if you see where the growth took place. Construction and manufacturing jobs are actually picking up, which he thinks is pulling people back into the labor force. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
There is more to talk about economy-wise than just jobs, of course, on this Friday. That is where, though, we are going to start our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government are in our studios in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Neela, two-word answer, maybe three if you really need it, this jobs report. How do you feel about it?
Underwhelming. Is that two words?
Okay. All right. No, that was really good. That was because most people can't actually do that. All right, Sudeep, two words, maybe three, same question.
I'll give you one. Sad.
Really? Sad?
I'm just sad, yes.
Sad seems more grim than underwhelming.
It is sad because we've gone through so much, we've seen so much excitement about what could have been a stronger recovery in 2014. Yeah. We had all of these expectations of stronger economic growth, consumers going out and spending more, businesses finally putting all that cash to good use. And what we're seeing is the labor market that we've had for the last 3 or 4 years, and perhaps even worse than what we've had for the last 3 or 4 years. And it's possible that this could just be a blip, we're going to come out of it, but it doesn't give us the upturn, the big, exciting move forward that we've all been waiting for.
Neela, do you believe this is a blip, that it's just a lousy blip and that it's going to get better?
Kai, I have to answer that with a question. What is it called when you keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result?
Insanity,
that's kind of what I think this economy is doing. We keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a momentum in hiring. And yet we haven't seen a sustained momentum in hiring. Every now and then we'll get two solid months in a row and then we revert back to this pattern.
Right.
And so unless there's some kind of trigger, I don't think that the economy is going to correct itself. And the Fed is now out of the recovery full force stimulus business for the jobs market.
Well, right, exactly. So let's talk about that, Sudeep. The Federal Reserve is, as we all know, tapering off its quantitative easing program, its bond buying and stimulus program. Do you think yet another weak jobs report will convince Janet Yellen to back off the taper, taper the taper, if I may coin a phrase?
If we get more disappointing jobs reports and, more importantly, other weak economic data to suggest that the second half of 2013 was more fluke than real, then yeah. it's certainly within the realm of possibility that Janet Yellen could do something as soon as March. But you're really going to have to see things fall apart in some much bigger way. The Fed went through all of this angst throughout last year. We had to deal with this taper question the entire time. How do we start now to stop the taper and then go through that again and wonder whether the recovery will fall apart if the Fed isn't in there buying bonds?
Right. And let's be clear, if Janet Yellen decides she has to do something, that things have gotten really bad, right? We absolutely don't want that, right?
It definitely sends that signal to the markets.
Neela, one more thing on this, and then I want to move on to a couple of other things. Do you suppose this jobs report and the others that have been equally lousy will convince Congress to change its mind on long-term unemployment benefits? They were cut off on the 28th of December. Now 1.6 million people out of work losing those benefits. What do you think?
Well, if they don't change their mind, there are 5 million people who will lose benefits this year. So this is a critical question that they'll have to answer. I hope that they are reading the data just like the Fed is and making decisions based on data and not partisan politics.
All right. Fair enough. Sudeep, last question to you. It is arguably the corporate story of the week. The new Microsoft CEO, Satya Nadella, was announced, Monday, Tuesday? I don't know. I've been traveling. Can he take that company where it needs to be in sort of the new economy, the Web 2.0 economy, the digital economy?
It's certainly possible. Microsoft became what it was, such an important, iconic company, by really pushing hard on innovation, changing how technology is in all of our lives. Figuring out how to be a mobile-based company, a cloud-based company, is a much different challenge. How they do that is the top of his list, and he has said that this week. But we look at the corporate landscape, you can see all sorts of companies that reshaped society and then stopped being on the corporate landscape and handed off to other innovative companies. So it's not entirely clear whether he's going to be able to pull it off with a company that large already.
Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal and Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. On Wall Street today, who cares? What the heck, right? Well, we do. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The number of the day today is 17,281,222,665,378.63. That is the most recent data for our national debt, the amount that Congress has authorized the Treasury Department to borrow. We have once again butted up against that limit today, in fact, and negotiations over what Republicans in the House will want in return for raising the debt ceiling will preoccupy official Washington for the next couple of weeks, to be sure. Elsewhere, though, the farther you get outside the Washington Beltway, not so preoccupied, really. And that brings us in a roundabout kind of way to one of Washington, D.C.'s lesser-known landmarks, and that is where we're going to bring in Marketplace's David Gura. David, you're on, man. Tell the good people where you are.
I'm at mile marker zero. That's a small monument kind of in the shadow of the Washington Monument, right between the Washington Monument and the White House. Stand out here in the cold.
That's right. Not as cold, I will tell you, as I am in St. Paul, some hundreds and hundreds of miles away.
I bet.
Describe this thing for us. Tell us what it is and tell us why it was built.
They put this marble here in the 1920s. There was this movement to get good roads throughout the United States. It was supposed to be our equivalent of the golden milestone they have in Rome. So it's the thing from which you'd measure all distances across the United States. I'm just going to read the inscription on it here. It says, "This is the point for the measurement of distances from Washington on highways of the United States."
I will point out that Google Maps tells me I am at mile marker 924 here in St. Paul from
Very
the
good.
Zero milestone. That's right.
And so there's this line, Kai, and I love it. President Harding spoke at the dedication of this mile marker back in 1923. So, of course, we don't have a recording of him saying it, but I found a local historian named Don Hawkins. He knows a lot about mile marker zero, and I asked him if he'd read this quote for me.
"It is appropriate that our golden milestone has been placed here in the national capital, the spiritual and institutional center of the nation. From it will diverge, to it will converge, the ceaseless tides whose movement will always keep our wide-flung population in that close intimacy of thought and interest and aim, which is so necessary to the maintenance of unity and nationality.
How awesome is that? The spiritual and industrial center of the nation. Could you get more Washington-centric than that?
A little hubris there, Kai. You know, and like so much stuff that comes out of Washington, this is something that really never went anywhere. As you said, I think Google Maps still uses it as the point of reference for distances from D.C. But you know, who else knows what this thing is or comes here to visit this thing specifically? That said, if you want to get a sense of why we have a debt ceiling, you don't really have to go too far from mile marker zero.
I'm Richard McCulley. I am the historian at the Center for Legislative Archives.
All right, so I walked over to the National Archives Building. That's just a few blocks down Pennsylvania Avenue, maybe a mile from mile marker zero. And McCulley has pulled some documents for us on the history of the debt ceiling, including the Second Liberty Bond Act of 1917.
This is how it all got started. When we talk about the debt limit today, it was with this particular bill.
This bill, the Second Liberty Bond Act, is regarded as the origin of establishing the statutory limit for the national debt.
So we were in the middle of World War I, the government needed money, and this set a limit on how many bonds the government could issue. McCulley tells me that before Congress voted on this, the Speaker of the House actually bragged about how this was, and I'm quoting here, the vastest sum ever raised by a legislative body.
After that, the House voted unanimously for this bill.
Unanimously.
Unanimously.
How about that?
Now, the Second Liberty Bond Act was amended a few times. In 1939, we got the first limit on all categories of debt. And here, McCulley tells me he wants to make a point. Those amendments were not controversial, and they all enjoyed bipartisan support.
That has morphed into this incredible headache for the Treasury now.
So here's how it works. Congress decides what to spend money on, and then later, lawmakers have to give the Treasury Department permission to pay those bills. And at the Treasury Department, which is about 500 steps from mile marker zero, they're waiting for that permission. Richard Clarida had to deal with all this when he was at the Treasury Department. He was an assistant secretary from 2001 until 2003. And Clarida's first boss was Paul O'Neill.
And I do remember sitting in a meeting once where one official looked at Secretary O'Neill and said, you know, we're getting a little chalk on our shoes right here. You know, we're a little bit too close to the line.
Clarida remembers using a debt ceiling playbook that was put together by two former Treasury secretaries, Robert Rubin and Larry Summers.
And they actually had a whole action plan folder that was available to the Treasury secretary. There are sort of steps that the secretary can take.
And Clarida bets that playbook is what the current Treasury secretary, Jack Lew, is using right now. It's full of what are called extraordinary measures. And one of them is basically moving money around from one government account to another.
What it is essentially an IOU that says, okay, I was supposed to give you $100 on Monday, so I'll give you, you know, $100 plus interest in a week.
But you can only do that for so long. These tricks will run out soon. And the Treasury Secretary says that's probably going to happen at the end of the month. So not a whole lot of time, Kai, which brings us to the Capitol. I'm in the rotunda beneath the apotheosis of George Washington, and we're about 2 miles from mile marker zero.
2 miles, not that far. What'd you do, take a cab?
We took a cab over here. All right. And, you know, what's really funny, Kai, is that the original plans called for mile marker zero to be right here, actually, on Capitol Hill.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. So the executive branch, I suppose, won that one.
They won that little battle, yeah.
They did, yeah. So the thing is, David, that Congress and the White House are going to be preoccupied by the debt limit fight for maybe a couple of weeks now. I don't know. But I did want to ask you on the way out, has it gotten worse? Has this fight gotten worse over time?
Yeah, I think it's happening more frequently. It's gotten more acrimonious. And I talked to Don Ritchie about this. He's the Senate's official historian. He's been through this a few times now. He's been in that position for a while. And he told me that, you know, this debate has always been controversial. You know, neither party wants to do this, but the long and the short of it is they got to do it.
It gets people riled up, but there really is not an alternative to increasing the debt limit. Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, used to say, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Marketplace's David Gura and the story of the zero milestone, the zero mile marker, and the debt limit. David, thanks a bunch.
Thanks, Kai.
We have built a map on our website, it's marketplace.org, of how that debt limit fight is and will play out around the country, mile marker zero and beyond. Go check it out. Help us out while you're there, by the way. Tell us how the debt debate feels where you are and, of course, how far you are away from Washington, D.C. Coming up.
I started my blog when I was 11, and I'll be 18 in a few months. So naturally, my interests have evolved as I've grown up.
She is not your average teenager, let me tell you that, people. Tavi Gevinson of Rookie Magazine coming up. But first, let's do the numbers. You thought a weak jobs report was bad news? The Dow Industrial is up 165 points today, 1% closed at 15,794. That's the first time I've ever done on the radio, by the way. The S&P up 23 points, about 1.3%, ended things at 1797. The NASDAQ was Friday's big winner, climbed 68 points, 1.3%, finished at 4125. For a week that started off poorly, you know, it ended up all right. The Dow up 0.6%, the NASDAQ climbed 0.5%, the S&P 500 up 0.8%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee holds a field hearing in Charleston, West Virginia, on the recent chemical spill that contaminated the area's water supply. The 138th Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show gets underway in New York City. And 65 years ago, we met the character Willie Loman when Death of a Salesman premiered on Broadway. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, when people hit a tough patch, what do? They take care of themselves, right? Get a self-help book, maybe. Make sure they eat right, get plenty of exercise. Maybe a little retail therapy, too. Who knows? Companies do that, too. You know, that last part. It's called a stock buyback, and Apple has just done it in grand style. The company has bought $14 billion worth of its own shares in the past 2 weeks since it reported some lackluster profits and saw its stock price tumble. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look at Apple's corporate self-help.
They say if you want to find love, you have to learn how to love yourself first. And the same goes for companies. Bill Krayer is a senior technology analyst with Edward Jones.
The reason that the company is doing this is they are trying to send a message to the market that they have confidence in the company's outlook and that they believe the market misunderstands the story and is undervaluing the future prospects.
I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people buy me.
It's kind of like hush money.
Paul Kodrowski is a partner with investment bank Garibaldi Capital. He says Apple's investors are frustrated their shares are losing value. And meanwhile, Apple's sitting on around $160 billion in cash reserves and doesn't appear to be investing in new research or buying up other companies.
You don't get to have it both ways. You don't get to hang on to it, not buy anything, not spend more money on R&D, and say, by the way, you investors can have it. You don't get to do that. You're a public company and you have obligations. And so they've created this trap for themselves and now they're stuck.
Also, investors like a buyback because it increases the value of their stock, says James Angel, a professor at Georgetown University.
The cool thing is, if you're a shareholder, you discover that suddenly you own a bigger fraction of the company.
There are fewer shares for sale, so those shares are worth more. All told, Apple has said it plans to spend about $60 billion on stock buybacks. That is a lot of self-love. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
After all the stories of stray dogs and missing plumbing in hotels and worries about terrorist attacks and controversies over civil rights in the host country, the Sochi Olympics were officially begun today. Of course, we couldn't see the opening ceremony live in this country because NBC didn't want us to. Tape delay is the name of the return on investment game, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
During the last Olympics, media expert Jeff Jarvis was one of the folks complaining about the lack of live Olympics programming.
This time, doesn't make much difference to me.
For one thing, he can access a lot more live games this year being streamed over the internet. He would like to see more live sports televised, which Jarvis argues wouldn't be bad for NBC's business.
As it turns out, when we knew what the results were from some events in the summer, it even drove more audience to watching the events. So I don't think that having it on live necessarily takes away from also having it tape delayed in prime time.
Of course, NBC isn't only concerned with this sound. After all, this sound is the moneymaker. The Tonight Show is getting a reboot, and during the Olympics, NBC will be promoting it nonstop, says Brad Adgate with the ad-buying firm Horizon Media.
I think we'll see a lot of promos of Jimmy Fallon. I think it's very smart that NBC is premiering the show February 17th while the Olympics is still going on.
NBC reportedly paid a little less than $900 million to produce and broadcast the Olympics coverage. The network has sold more than $800 million worth of ads so far, a record for the Winter Games. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Fashion is, as we know, a big, big business. A point never more clear than when Fashion Week rolls into New York City, which it did yesterday for its customary 7-day run. So today we are going to talk to a fashion blogger. At least, she started out as a fashion blogger when she was 11 years old. By the time she was 13, she was turning heads at fashion shows herself. Tavi Gevinson is 17 now and well on her way to being a media powerhouse. Her latest project is a lifestyle website for girls and younger women called Rookie. She's got a staff of about 50 people working for her, which she manages between homework and just being 17 years old. Tavi, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Are you going to Fashion Week?
I'm not this year.
How come?
I just didn't have a reason to go this time. I don't write my fashion blog anymore, and I, of course, there are always a few shows I'd like to see, but you do miss school and there are a bit of compromises and it costs money and I just wasn't feeling it this time around.
Fair enough. Why did you go from writing about a lot about fashion on a blog to doing a different kind of thing with Rookie?
Well, part of it is just that I started my blog when I was 11 and I'll be 18 in a few months. So naturally, my interests have evolved as I've grown up. You know, sometimes I'd go to Fashion Week and it would be really magical and it would outweigh the fluff that we were kind of talking about, but sometimes it wouldn't. And when I started my blog, I was in middle school and I didn't really feel accepted by my peers and I would get like bullied for my outfit. So it was like a cool little secret that then I could go to this other world and feel accepted. But you know, then once I started high school, like I said, my interests started shifting, but I also had more of a life at home. Yeah. And so I didn't feel like I needed that outlet as much anymore.
What kind of boss are you?
I think our staff is really close. Like it feels like, a real community. Right now I'm wearing a t-shirt that we made just for our staff, not to sell on the site or anything, that says coming for your job, because it's just the most supportive group of women and a couple guys that I've ever been a part of. To me, it completely debunks any stereotype that women are competitive and catty. It's like everyone, you know, wants everyone else to do well. And also sometimes like we kind of have group therapy and it's really, I wrote one of my college essays about, it was like, what's the community that shaped you the most? And I talked about all of the amazing women I work with.
My guess is what you write in your college essay isn't going to really matter. You're going to get to go where you want to go to school. But maybe that's just me. But it brings up a really good question, which is, you are what, 17, almost 18? You're a senior in high school. You are about to pass out of that zone where everybody can look at you and go, oh man, what a talented kid.
Right.
How different is it going to be when people, when you are an actual adult, you know, and you can't get away with the whole I'm just a kid thing?
Yeah. For sure, it won't be like, she's so good for 17.
Right, gosh, she's only 17, yeah.
Yeah, and to me, that's freeing. I would love to be able for, you know, I would love for my work to be judged on its own. I would love to be looked at as a person and not a novelty. So I really hate how we fetishize youth and young success stories, even though I know that I'm a part of that as kind of an example of that. So I'm just eager to get away from, you know, everything I do being looked at through that lens.
On the theory that you're a pretty goal-oriented person, what are the goals that you still have that are out there?
Well, I'm really eager to graduate high school now. I'm a senior.
That's a good one.
So, yeah. And then once that happens, I can work on Rookie full time in person with our other editors in New York. And there are, you know, there are kind of like boring goals like, oh, I want to redesign the site and like raise our contributors' rates and whatever. But I don't want to share because you don't want to set yourself up for like failure, talk big or whatever. But all I will say is that I have a folder on my desktop that says world domination. So I'll leave that there. And it's not me. It's like I want Rookie to take over the world.
Tavi Gevinson, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I suppose tells you where my brain is at the end of a long week, stuck somewhere between economic policy and a nice frosty glass of beer. From the website Quartz, a chart of how many hours it takes working minimum wage to afford a beer at a bar or restaurant in whatever country the work is being done. We've got the whole thing on our website, but here are some highlights. Here in the U.S. of A., it takes 4/10 of an hour. That is 24 minutes at a minimum wage to buy a beer. Russia, just because of the Olympics, just over an hour and a half per beer. Bangladesh, 13 and a half hours for one beer. You can check out the whole thing, marketplace.org. And with that, we are out of time. It's Marketplace from APM on a Friday. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the Vice President and Executive Producer. Thanks today to the staff here in St. Paul at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're out of here. See you Monday back in L.A., everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.